PhD in Princeton, and I was lucky enough to collaborate with him remotely, and then went to see him after that. Go ahead.
Okay, thanks very much. So my talk will be about three topics that I have convinced myself can peacefully coexist in under an hour. So the first part will be called binary black hole merger, symmetry and the spin expansion, and this is about a way to understand what happens when two black holes that are spiraling around each other emit gravitational waves and eventually merge to form a single black hole. The second part will be called light loop echoes and blinking black holes, and this is an idea about how one might hope to detect light rays that loop around a black hole before proceeding to the observer. And then the final part will be called testing inflation, a bootstrap approach. And this is a thought about how one might hope to put inflation, the inflationary paradigm, and in particular, the idea that the universe underwent a brief period of expansion followed by a brief period of accelerated expansion followed by a long period of decelerated expansion on a firmer footing. And so in short, the first part is sort of, I'll be using both my fists. The second part will be about just one of my fists. And the third part is my sincere hope that I will not have to use either of my fists. I mean, just because I'm... okay, so let me just plunge in. So binary black hole merger, symmetry, and the spin expansion. The idea here is that there is a basic puzzle. So many of you have probably heard that ever since Kerr solved the one-body problem in general relativity back in 1963, ever since then people have been trying to make progress on the two-body problem, and ever since shortly after then, people have been trying to simulate that problem numerically on a computer, and that has turned out to be remarkably difficult. It took decades to even get a single simulation of the merger of two black holes into one black hole to run without crashing. So to get to the point where there was actually a single event horizon and the solution proceeded to the end without falling apart, that took like three decades. But that in 2005 there was a big breakthrough, and it was finally achieved by several different groups using a couple different methods. And so there are a lot of interesting things that have come out of that, but I want to just focus on one, which is that, okay, so in late 2005 people got their first merger simulations working, and then they did some, they tested things, they computed waveforms in 2006. Then 2007 arrived. In 2007, in short, I can summarize this part of GRQC as follows, which is that every group, now there were maybe six groups or something like that, was simulating like crazy spinning black holes. Spinning black holes were the topic of interest. And every month, roughly, a new paper would appear on GRQC with the following basic point that they had chosen some new one parameter configuration of simulations. They had done 10 or 20 simulations and found that surprisingly that the results for the final quantities that they computed, the final spin of the final black hole, the final kick vector, recoil kick of the final black hole, or the final mass, that they all seemed to lie along very simple, they seemed to be fit by very simple functions. And maybe they would lie almost perfectly along a line, or they would be fit almost perfectly by a sine wave. And so the question is, this is kind of a very appealing puzzle. What is going on here? On the one hand, this is one of the most notoriously difficult and thorny sort of nonlinear problems in physics, and it took decades to even get a single simulation to run without crashing. And yet, at the end of the day, once the simulations began to work, everywhere you looked, the answer was simpler than expected. So where, you know, so simple patterns deserve simple explanations. What is the one for this? I will try to describe a resolution to that, which is from these two papers from the past year or year and a half. And the basic idea, to cut to the chase, is that instead of I would like to understand these patterns by, instead of trying to follow in detail the dynamics of the merger through the horrible nonlinear intermediate phase, I want to make use of the fact that that there is the so-called no-hair theorem, a theorem, you know, phrased appropriately, a theorem in general relativity that guarantees you that long before and long after the merger, the system is very simple. It consists of two widely separated black holes, or one final black hole, each of which is locally very symmetric and, for all intents and purposes, characterized by just a few numbers, namely the masses and spins and instantaneous momenta of the black holes. And so the idea is to ask, okay, instead of thinking about the detailed dynamics, let's think about the map from this simple initial state to the simple final state, and see whether we can find a way of looking at this map and applying the remaining symmetry, the remaining constraints of symmetry to this map to understand where these various observed patterns are coming from. So instead of treating the general case, it's better to just treat a particular example, and that the other cases they differ only in details. So here I'm going to think about the particular quantity K1. So by K1 I mean the kick vector K. So as the black holes in spiral, they emit gravitational radiation in all directions. And in general, the momentum emitted will not cancel out to zero. They will emit some net linear momentum in some direction. And then to conserve momentum in the center of mass frame of the whole system, the final black hole has to recoil with an opposite momentum to the momentum emitted. So it'll have some recoil kick. And I am interested in the component of that recoil kick projected onto what I'll call the one direction, by which I just mean the direction between black hole A and black hole B at the moment when I specify the initial conditions for the system. Okay, so at some initial state, I tell you the configuration of the system, then I let my simulation evolve, and then at the end of the day, I want to know what is the component of the kick projected onto that direction. That's what I'm calling K1. Okay, and for simplicity, let's just talk about the simplest case, which is equal mass black holes, which can have arbitrary spins, but have equal masses and are initially in a circular orbit. So then it turns out that to specify that system, if I'm interested in black holes that are in a circular orbit, to specify that system, I have to give seven dimensionless numbers, it turns out. I have to give Q, the mass ratio, and then I have to give the three components of this black hole spin and three components of this black hole spin. And that's enough data to set up my numerical simulation. I let the thing evolve. Okay, so basically, by using the no-hair theorems, I've jumped from the initial data, which I call Q, which is the mass ratio, A1, A2, A3, which are the three components of spin A, B1, B2, B3, which are the three components of spin B, to the final kick vector. And a priori, all I know is that it is some arbitrary function of those initial seven numbers.
You don't have to worry about the fact that it's GR and you have coordinate systems when you specify A and B as vectors. You mean
So basically, I'm starting them so far apart that it's a Newtonian bind. You know, if I look long before, I know the GR reduces to Newtonian mechanics. And so in a Newtonian system of two orbiting spinning particles, this is the information that I need to give. And so in other words, so it is true that as they get closer and closer together, that the measure of the mass of each particle becomes ambiguous, and that the measure of the spin of each particle becomes more and more ambiguous. And that ambiguity goes away in the limit that they're far apart. But in fact, it actually that's okay too. So if you just look concretely at each of these simulations, they have some concrete meaning of what they mean by the when they start with the black holes a finite distance away. Where they can't be thought of as separate curved black holes, there is some distortion due to the neighboring black hole and so forth. But okay, they specify some particular prescription for defining the mass of the whole and defining the spin of the whole. And as long as those prescriptions don't violate the symmetries that I'm going to use, then it's okay. The arguments still go through. You'll get a slightly different expansion if you use a slightly different definition of the mass of the initial masses and spins. But if two different groups know what their two definitions of mass and spin are, they can convert between them. Physically, there's one other thing. So you can imagine you can think about setting up the coordinate system as for example. You might be worried that I was talking about the one direction on the direction between the two black holes initially. What do I mean by projecting the final kick vector onto that one direction? And you know, the statement is that physically I can set up celestial coordinates on the sphere long before merger by saying, the equatorial plane of the celestial coordinates is just the plane of the orbit far from merger. That becomes a well-defined plane, and even when it begins precessing, it precesses on scales much longer than the orbital time scale. So in other words, if I'm sitting in the center between the two black holes and looking out, I see that as they sweep around the sky, they're obscuring some ring of stars around me. That's the equatorial plane of my coordinate system. And similarly, if I hover locally near the symmetry axis of either of the two black holes, and look up at the sky, then on a time scale short relative to the orbit and relative to the precession of the orbital plane, I see the stars above me whirling around. And there's a star directly overhead that is fixed. And that's the point in my celestial coordinates where that spin points. And that is the similar you can do. As long as you're only interested in measuring these quantities significantly before and significantly after merger, there's a perfectly physical meaning of each of these quantities, and all defined relative to a fixed coordinate system you establish on the celestial sphere surrounding the system, which is there both before and after the merger takes place. You define it exactly as an astronomer would. Okay, so a priori, I only know that it's a function of these seven numbers. Where can I go from here? Well, I'm going to do the dumbest thing, which is to Taylor expand in the six spin components. And actually, this sounds like the dumbest thing, but it took a while to figure out that this is, took some playing around to figure out that this is the right thing to do. But anyway, this turns out to be a good idea. And it looks at first glance like a big mess because it's a six-dimensional Taylor expansion. And so there's tons of, it seems naively that there are tons of terms at each order in the Taylor expansion, but things are not so bad as they seem. So, for example, let me say about my notation here. So the idea here, the notation is that M1, M2, M3, N1, N2, N3 are all indices that I'm summing from n equals 0 to infinity. And so this is a coefficient, and this is the coefficient of the term in the Taylor expansion with A1 to the M1th power, A2 to the M2th power, etc. And so naively, at zeroth order, you have one term in that Taylor expansion, but it turns out that is killed due to symmetry. When you merge two black holes, which is just says physically, when you merge two black holes of equal mass and zero spin, there it turns out there's no final kick velocity by symmetry. So as you go on to first order, it looks naively like there are six terms in the expansion, six independent coefficients, but in fact there's only one. Which is a term, there's a coefficient that you don't know times A3 minus B3. So this is the leading order prediction of the formalism, is that to a first approximation, if I start off my two black holes and give them any spins you want, that the final kick velocity in that direction will only depend on the projections of both of those spins onto the three axis, which is I'm calling the direction of the orbital angular momentum, this direction. So I take the projective on here, and in particular only onto the difference between those two. So why is that the case? that happens. That can be simply understood because, so you might have naively expected, again, six terms, one for A1, A2, A3, and similarly for the Bs. And where did the A1, A2, B1, B2 terms go? They die because they just have the wrong sign under parity. If you imagine doing a parity transformation on the whole system and ask, okay, how will the final kick velocity change? How will the direction from black hole A to black hole B change? And how will the initial spins change? You find that A3 and B3 change consistently with K1, but all the things with subscript 1 and 2 don't. So they have to drop out. So if I imagine literally taking the whole initial state in whole initial configuration like this and mapping it through the origin, so I now have a new state like this, that the final state has to map through the origin exactly the same way. So we're left with just A3 and B3 at first order. And the reason those have to appear only in the combination A3 minus B3 is that I can ask, so to write down this map, I had to call one black hole A and the other black hole B. But clearly, I could have just as well labeled this black hole A and this black hole B, and the final physical kick vector can't depend on that. And so, if you again just follow through how everything in this expression transforms under just a relabeling like that, you find that these guys can only appear in this combination of minus something. That's a very elementary argument, obviously. And yet, the point is that already you've gotten up to a single coefficient, but turns out to be a very accurate description of the simulation results for this quantity. And then you can continue to second order. Naively, there's going to be something like 25 terms, but then similar arguments cut out all but five in this case. And so let me just give you a sense of how well this actually does. So without going into detail, for the sake of time, this is as of the end of 2007. This gives you a rough idea of all the simulations that were done. The simulations are very time intensive. Each one of them takes something like 100,000 hours of CPU time. So with all these groups working, you still don't have a huge number of simulations. You have sort of hundreds. And so each black dot on here is a simulation. And then the various curves show the leading order predictions for these various quantities, various components of the final kick or the mass or the final spin vector. And the point is that they are very, very well fit by just this leading order expansion, leading order Taylor expansion in the spins, supplemented by these very very simple elementary symmetry arguments.
You have two equal masses, is that right?
The arguments go through whether you do or do not have equal masses.
I see. So you get the same formula.
So I was focusing for simplicity on equal masses, and because almost all of the initial simulations for spinning black holes were done at equal masses. But so I can tell you quickly what happens for the unequal mass case. For the unequal mass case, you want to play the same game in the Q direction, in the mass ratio direction. But clearly, you don't want to Taylor expand Q around Q equals one. Q lies in this region between zero and infinity. And so the first thing to do is to switch to a variable that is more, basically the game works so well in the spin direction, we want to see, is there a variable that's exactly that we can change from Q that will behave just like a spin variable? And there is a simplest choice, which is Q minus one over Q plus one. This has the property that whereas Q ran between zero and infinity, alpha runs between minus 1 and 1, just like one of the spin components. What I didn't mention, I forgot to mention, an important thing about saying what is interesting about these results is that the initial the spin of a curved black hole is limited. In dimensionless units, in units in which G is equal to C is equal to the mass of the black hole is equal to 1, the spin vector of a black hole has magnitude between 0 and 1, which is one of the reasons that it's not crazy to try a Taylor expansion of these variables, because at least they don't run up to infinity. But naively, you would probably expect, and we certainly expected, that okay, maybe this Taylor expansion would work for tiny spins, but it's a very nonlinear problem. Presumably it'll get very nonlinear, the expansion will get very nonlinear as you approach maximal spins, a equals one. That is not the case at all. Most of these simulations, in fact, are done for nearly maximal spins. They're done for spins of 0.6, 0.8. The only reason they're not done for higher spins is just that there still are technical problems with setting up the initial data for nearly maximum spinning black holes. But the point is, this is part of what's so interesting is that the expansion
works remarkably well even up to essentially the as far as one can tell based on the simulations that were available at the end of 2007, basically up to high spin, up to significant fractions of maximum spin.
So, okay, back to this. So you switch to alpha, which runs between minus one and one, and then the relevant symmetry, which is exchange of the labels of the two black holes here, maps Q to 1 over Q. And in terms of alpha, that maps alpha to minus alpha, which again is just like how one of the spin components behaves under parity. And the point of symmetry, Q equals 1, is right at the middle, alpha equals 0. So this is a nice variable to use. And what you find is that when you expand in terms of alpha, you do a Taylor expansion in terms of alpha, that at each order in alpha, you get exactly the same formula that you would have gotten for the equal mass case. So it turns out that if you want to calibrate all possible final quantities up to second order in this spin expansion at equal mass, you have to do only 10 simulations. Okay, there's only 10 appropriately chosen simulations. We'll nail perfect simulations. Would be able to determine all of the 10 relevant coefficients. And what I'm saying is that now, at every order in alpha, what you find is that in a way that I don't have time to describe, the quantities sort of permute amongst each other, but ultimately every order in alpha just requires 10 more simulations. And although there are more limited simulations available for the unequal mass case, and so I don't talk about them in detail here, there are hints that there is limited evidence that a similar thing goes on in the Q direction. That is to say that this expansion in alpha, which certainly will be good at least as long as you're near Q equals one, as long as you're near relatively similar mass black holes, also does seems to do a remarkably good convergence, even as you get closer to the boundaries of Q equals plus or minus one. Okay, so I was just going to focus in for to give a little more detailed idea of exactly what I'm comparing here. Let me just focus on this top panel because it's easy to explain. These are two different groups simulating the same one parameter family of initial spin configurations. And as they vary that one parameter, the first order term in the first order prediction of the spin expansion is that the final kick that they get in the three direction in this case should vary as a sine wave with its about zero, and with precisely this frequency, in other words, one oscillation per this unit of parameter. And then furthermore, these two groups did the same basic configuration, but they scaled up their spins by use different overall magnitudes for their initial spins. So the prediction is that the amplitudes of these sine waves should scale by exactly the same factor, and they do. And then the next to leading order prediction is that if you now look at the tiny residuals about this, that the tiny residuals should, that there should be no, there should be, if this is sine theta, there should be no sine 2 theta dependence, and that the residuals should oscillate as sine 3 theta, which they do to a very good approximation, and that the amplitude of the residuals should scale between the two sets as the cube of the magnitudes of the initial spins, which they do to a very good approximation. So this is just to show in a little bit of detail for this case that it really just gives astonishingly accurate results. So a few comments to end this part of the talk. So why, who should be interested? So first of all, there are no numerical relativists in the audience, I realize, but I will say that the most immediate practical application is in numerical relativity, because simulations are very time consuming. So you can do one simulation, but it takes a long time. Whereas even in the simplest case, where you just focus on circular orbits, the parameter space is physically distinct mergers is 7 parameters. And so even if you just tried to crudely grid that with 10 grid points along each direction, that would be 10 to the 7 simulations, which is hopeless. So the practical point here is that this is a way to map out that same space with far fewer parameters. The point is you don't have to naively grid it, because it has all of this structure, and it has and if expanded in the right way, obeys this very simple expansion, is very well fit by the leading order terms in that expansion. And so in fact, Mike Kasdan, my co-author, and I derived a list of the simplest independent spin configurations that you should simulate to calibrate the simulation up to second order, and that has been done by my two heroes, Tishy and Marinetti. I don't have a numerical code, so I can't do the thing myself. But so these guys are awesome, and in July, they wrote a short paper announcing that they'd done these simulations and that they were continuing to fitting well. But my understanding is that they're working on a longer paper, which actually, so they didn't, for example, report the calibration. They didn't show the calibration coefficients. They didn't report the components of their final quantities. And so anyway, the more detailed paper is apparently in the works, and we're looking forward to it. But so the hope is that once you have this calibrated expansion, so what it is it's a map that tells you, long before merger, if you know the initial configuration, the initial mass ratio, and the initial spins of the black holes, and you're only interested, as you are in many contexts, in the final output of that merger, then you don't have to follow it in detail. You just use this calibrated map, and it just tells you what the final black hole is, what its kick velocity, spin, and mass are. And this, you can imagine, is useful in a wide variety of astrophysical contexts. For example, in cosmological n-body simulations, we know that supermassive black holes play a very important role in galaxies, galaxy mergers, galaxy evolution. And when two galaxies merge, their supermassive black holes form a binary that is also expected to merge. The outcome of that merger is important. But it's obviously hopeless for a cosmological code to follow that merger in any detail. What they need is a map that says, okay, once the black holes get close enough together that you think gravity is going to be the dominant force for the rest of their interaction, you know, at the next time step, what black hole should I replace? What single black hole should I replace that by? Similarly, if you can predict astrophysical distributions of these parameters prior to merger, this map, you just convolve with this map and get predicted astrophysical distributions of the mass, spin, and kick of black holes after the merger. These are all in various ways observable quantities. And then finally, for gravitational waveforms, at the very least, this will be interesting because, so gravitational waveform has basically three parts. There is an early in-spiral phase when the black holes are far apart. Then there is a merger phase when the black holes get close together. And then there is a ring down when you have basically a distorted final single black hole that has to relax down to its final stationary Kerr state. So this part is already well under control with post-Newtonian methods. But the really strong gravity regime that's really of most interest, the thing that gravitational waves detectors that will tell us that in some sense is the most interesting probe of strong gravity, has to do with this region. And in particular, the spectrum of quasi-normal modes that you see here depends on the mass and spin and also the kick relative to you of the final black hole. And so at the very least, this map will immediately will be able to tell you, as you see a merger coming down the pike, what is going to be, what you can predict, what is the final spin, kick, and mass going to be, and therefore what is the spectrum of ring downloads that I expect to see over here. And then a hope that I have that is that it will also be useful for fitting this very interesting region, because again, this is a region that has to be simulated by numerical simulations. And the, well, so the in principle, what you do here is each numerical simulation, you take these, this small set of suggested independent spin configurations that you simulate. Each one of those produces a full time-dependent waveform that, in principle, you can have your computer measure over a sphere at some fixed radius away from the binary. If you decompose that waveform into spherical harmonics, each of those independent spherical harmonics transforms under the various symmetries, just like one of the kick or spin components that I've been talking about. And so, in principle, you can it is the case that you can determine up to second order in the spin expansion the final waveform at that coming through a sphere of that radius using the exact same set of simulations. Now, what is not clear is that the expansion will work well. I mean, so in other words, the fact that the expansion seems to converge fast for the final quantities, asymptotic final quantities like the mass and spin, it's not at all clear that means that it will converge quickly for the waveform. But in any case, it's an interesting thing to play around with, and something that nobody has played around with yet, because reliable waveforms are sort of just coming online. Okay, and then the final thing is that it's theoretically interesting, and the gravitational few body problem is a centuries old problem that has sort of been at the center of physics. Of course, Newton's solution of the Newtonian one and two body problems ignited modern physics, of course. We don't need to say anything more about that. But then Poincaré's understanding of why the three body problem could not be solved in a similar way led to the modern theory of chaos. Then Einstein came along and said, you know, you guys have been solving the wrong few body problem. You have to solve my relativistic few body problem. And that seemed very hard. People despaired of finding an exact solution to that until Kerr found his miraculously simple and beautiful solution in the 1960s. And then shortly after that, people despaired of finding a nice solution of the two-body problem. And so they immediately turned to approximation methods, almost immediately turned to mainly to approximation methods and numerical simulations. And the difficulty of those numerical simulations made it seem like that was, you know, a very sensible decision, and it's just a question of whether that needs some rethinking in light of the fact that the results of the simulations are in some sense simpler than expected. So I mean, you know, there's an interesting theoretical puzzle here about what ultimately is at the root of why the map from the initial to final state is so simply fit in this way, and I even have. I even have kind of a crackpotty notion about that, but that I will not say on camera, but would be happy to talk at lunch about. But anyway, so with that said, I would like to go on to the next part of my talk. Unless there are any questions, more questions.
Now, even I would have thought that maybe the kick would depend on initial separation and on the initial orbital angle.
So it does depend on the initial separation, but in other words, when I say set up the initial mass ratio and initial spin, I mean keeping the initial separation fixed. But now, if you want to know the answer for another initial separation, you don't need to reperform simulations for that initial separation because if you look at two wide separations and you calibrate at this separation. The answer at this separation can be obtained by using the post-Newtonian equations of motion to evolve the spins back from this initial separation to this initial separation. In other words, ultimately these are the same physical systems, just evaluated at two different points in their end spiral, and the equations of motion to connect them at these two widely separated regimes are well known. So you do have to work to do, you know, you do have to do the work to connect the calibration to whatever radius you want. But that work is just you know, is pencil and paper work. Okay. Light loop echoes and blinking black holes. In brief, general relativity has turned out to be much easier to test in the weak field regime than in the strong field regime. And one of the great goals of astronomy is to come up with a really convincing test of general relativity in the strong field regime, not in the solar system. In particular, this shows up in gravitational lensing, where all of the lensing that so gravitational lensing is the phenomenon where a background source sends light to you, passes by a massive object, the rays are bent according to general relativity, and so you see, so you with your eye over here can see the image distorted and magnified by the intervening lensing. So, but all of the lensing that we have detected so far, be it weak lensing or strong lensing, you know, so even these pictures where you see from Keck or from the Hubble Space Telescope, where you look at a cluster of galaxies and you see multiple images of the same galaxy and it's stretched out into a banana, you know, in one of the images. These all correspond to all of those light rays that you're detecting are bent by tiny angles, very tiny angles. So one way to phrase this question of how to obtain a test of strong gravity is there some way, we know that in certain contexts, general relativity predicts that light rays should be strongly bent, is there some way to detect those strongly bent rays? So in particular, it has been long known that when light rays pass through a black hole, in addition to the primary sort of leading order ray, which just gets bent and then comes to you, there is another ray that passes closer to the black hole and it loops once before coming to you, and then another ray that loops twice, and so forth, in principle, forever. So is there any way to detect any of those other looping rays? At this point, for rhetorical purposes, I would like to invoke a nemesis who I will call Mark Wyman. So Mark Wyman says, no way. I can show you why that is never going to work. So, and here is Mark's rather compelling argument. He says, suppose that we're looking at the black hole. The source is behind the black hole, and so I'm just looking at this picture from the standpoint of the observer. Then this first ray and all of the other rays that pass around the hole will produce some large, in the limit that the source is directly aligned behind the black hole, those rays will produce some large Einstein ring somewhere around the black hole. And then these other looping rays will produce very tiny black holes lying just outside, very, very tiny Einstein rings lying just outside the shadow of the black hole. Okay, and they sort of pile up here. So Mark says, I'll give you the best case scenario. Because it's known that just as in the limit that you have an actual point source and you perfectly align it behind the black hole, the magnification of this ring is infinite, formally infinite. Similarly, the same is true for these things, that the flux that you measure in any of these rings diverges as 1 over the alignment angle. So in the limit that you perfectly align the source, all of these rings will diverge. So he says that means this is your best case. This is the case where those rings are brightest. But now let me calculate the ratio of brightness of any of these rings to the outer ring. So I'll call this the J equals 0 ring, and this the J equals 1, 2, 3. So what happens when he calculates the ratio of the brightness? He gets this formula. And so he says, look at this factor. So ds is the distance from the observer to the source. dl is the distance from the observer to the lens. dls is the distance from the lens to the source. And then m is the mass of the black hole, which is basically the radius of the black hole. He says, look at this factor. M is absurdly tiny relative to either of these two numbers. in a normal gravitational lensing configuration. So you know these other rays that you're interested in are suppressed by a hopelessly large factor. So this objection is easily overcome, because you see that if we bring the source very close to the black hole, what? It's just Mark, you have more to say than what I'm already saying.
I don't want to disagree.
So if you bring the lens very close to the source, so close that it is basically at the Schwarzschild radius, then the ratio of this to this becomes order one, and furthermore, the ratio of the distance from me to the source and me to the lens also becomes order one. So this factor becomes order one. I say no problem, and he says that won't do you a bit of good. Won't do you a bit of good because there's still this factor, which says that every additional ring, every time the black hole wraps an addition, every time the ray wraps an additional 2 pi, you're penalized another factor of e to the 2 pi, e to the minus 2 pi in intensity. And in fact, this is a more general phenomenon. That as you wrap, for these strongly bent rays, if you every time you wrap an additional delta theta, you're penalized in e to the minus delta theta in intensity. So e to the minus 2 pi, that's a big number. That's several hundred. He says any realistic, you know, a telescope that you might have will only have a diameter range of 1,000 at best, and so you know this is hopeless. You know, even if you can detect the first ring, and the other ones will be suppressed just as much. So the answer to that objection is to consider a different lensing geometry. The point is, we chose this lensing geometry because it formally made these rings the brightest. But the astrophysically more important question is the one that he ultimately turned to, which is the ratio of the brightness of the subsequent rings to the brightness of the primary ring. And for that purpose, a better configuration is this one. And you can see, roughly speaking, why here. So first of all, I've brought the source very near the black hole, but then I've also moved it to 90 degrees, because now, if the zeroth ray reaches me this way, the first ray, the j equals 1 ray reaches me this way, it's only executed an extra pi instead of 2 pi, and this guy again. And so now it is unavoidably the case that they will be suppressed by an e to the minus delta phi. But at least if I take this configuration by having them wrapped clockwise and counterclockwise and weave together in this way, I can at least pay a price of only e to the minus pi, which is about a factor of 10, which is much more manageable. Okay, so fine.
Should I not be impressed by that prefactor that you didn't talk about? It was just the numbers?
The number?
Four,
well, it's an order one thing. It's a number of about 10, actually, and I can come back to that. Right? So there's a dimensionless factor of about 10, which actually you'll see will play a little bit more. Okay. So we want to do this now. Now we need, of course, an astrophysical context in which such a source is given to us. And well, the natural place, if you want a source of light right near a black hole, the obvious candidate is the accretion disk. That's the main way that we have observational access to black holes, is that they're surrounded by disks of accreting matter that extend down very close to the black hole horizon. They're believed to extend down essentially to the so-called innermost stable circular orbit of the horizon, which is comparable to the horizon radius. So we imagine our source is there, but then there is, we'll be interested in spinning black holes. The main reason that we're interested in spinning black holes, well, first of all, there is good reason to think, both theoretically and observationally, that many, if not most, of the black holes observed in nature, and the AGN in particular, are spinning in a significant fraction of unity, and some of them are even claimed observationally to be spinning at 0.8, 0.9, even 0.99 of unity. So we're interested in them for that reason, but we're also interested in them because it turns out that as you spin up a black hole, the innermost stable circular orbit drops significantly. It drops from 6m for an unspinning black hole to 1m for a highly spinning black hole. And so there's a big gain. There's a gain of a factor of 6 in terms of being able to bring the source close to the hole, roughly speaking. We'll get to the more detailed calculation in a second. For a highly spinning black hole, there is a result known as the Bardeen-Petterson effect, which is that there is an effective viscous force due to the bottom line of the Bardeen-Petterson effect is that is that we are confident that the inner part, the most inner regions of an accretion disk of a highly spinning black hole, are aligned with the black hole. That is, they lie in the equatorial plane of the black hole. So I should think of this as the equatorial plane of the black hole, which means that the observer is looking down the spin axis. And that's fortuitous, again, astrophysically, because, okay, there are two sort of special limiting cases. If you have a black hole, there are two limiting cases that you might think about. There's the case where you look at it edge-on and the case that you look at it face-on. And we know that of those two, the more realistic one is the face-on configuration, because it is believed that that most black holes, if they're seen close to edge-on, are obscured by, most AGN are obscured by dust. So the black holes where we see really X-ray emission from down in close to the black hole, those are black holes that we're seeing somewhat close to face-on. So that's enough motivation. Let's calculate how big the signal is for these spinning black holes. So here I'm taking the limiting case where I look straight down the spin axis, and in this case I'm plotting two things. Okay, the upper panel shows relative to the initial flash that I imagine a flash goes off. Okay, at the interstable circular orbit, and I ask, okay, two things will happen. First of all, I will see subsidiary flashes. They will be delayed in time. So after the first flash, I'll see a J equals one flash, and then a J equals two flash, and a J equals three flash, because the different paths to me have different times that they take to reach me. And then also they have different intensities relative to the initial flash. So the top panel here shows you the time delay of the J equals one, two, and three loops relative to the first one. And then the ratio of intensity. And so what you see is that as a function of the spin parameter, which again goes from zero for a non-spinning black hole to one for a maximally spinning black hole. And what you see is that for a highly spinning black hole, let's say of 0.8, that the first flash is only down by a factor of 8 or something relative to the initial burst. And the second guy, the guy who is looped by a full 2 pi, or 3 pi over 2, depending on how you count it, is down by less than 1%. Is it something like 2% of the initial signal? And the delays are something like 20m or 40m. So that 20m or 40m, and put in real units, that's so if m is 10 solar masses, so we're talking about a stellar mass black hole, that is a delay of about 1 millisecond, which is short, although not so short that it can't be detected with X-ray. So there have been past X-ray telescopes that actually have time tagging at comparable to this level, and I believe that the next X-ray telescope, the ESA NASA Grand X-ray Telescope, I believe is supposed to have timing accuracy better than that. But then the other case, the case perhaps of more importance, is a supermassive black hole, which is something like 10 to the 6 M sun to 10 to the 9 M sun. And there you're talking about a time delay from about 1 minute to a day, which is perfectly detectable. So that's what would happen if you got a flash from the innermost stable circular orbit of a black hole with this spin, and you were viewing it along the spin axis. So this is the first basic result, is that the highly bent rays are not negligible relative to the initial ray. And even if you can't resolve the difference between these images on the sky, which of course you cannot because they're too close together, you could still hope to see the signature of this blinking effect a few blinks after a big burst in the light curve received in the time, in the intensity as a function of time received from this source. Here I show the when put in front of a crowd, I it's irresistible to go on tangents that always make things go about 50% longer than I in practice runs. Yeah.
So if you look at this IOJ stuff, then they would have to go through the ring again. So
excellent question.
You're assuming that they're not going to get absorbed, diffused, or that the ring is transparent.
Very good point. Very good point. I was going to get to that, but let's just do that. So so there's two parts answer to that question. Right. So in fact, this is the main reason that people had not, I think. So there's actually an old paper by Bardeen where he considers a star of fixed intensity orbiting a black hole, and he asks what the light curve will be for various observers. And he kind of neglects these higher order rings because he says probably they will be, you know, they have to pass through the equatorial plane and won't they be killed? So that's not true. I mean, it will be true for some of the rings, but the reason again, the first simplest model of a disk, and the model that is probably correct for certain some black holes, is the geometrically thin, optically thick accretion disk. So it's a thin pancake, but it's optically thick, so a ray that hits it does not pass. So let's say that I emit from somewhere, and this terminates at the interstable circular bar. Okay. Now, say I emit from the top of the disk here, and I'm looking at a ray that, you know, goes like this. I can draw it this way because because when the light ray orbits, it orbits very close to the so-called polar light ray. There's a particular radius that relevant to a face on observer. And when it's doing its orbiting, the light ray sticks very close to that radius. So the relevant question is, and so in a geometrically thin, optically thick disk, what happens is that as you cross this transition, the idea is that the matter suddenly goes from slowly spiraling inward to suddenly plunging into the black hole. There are no stable circular orbits beyond this. You plunge essentially straight in, but that means that there's a sudden jump. There's like a phase transition where the radius, the velocity in the radial direction, the inflow velocity of matter, suddenly takes a big jump right there. And so, by conservation of mass, if you want to conserve m dot in a stationary state, total amount of m dot going in, that means that the surface density has to drop dramatically between here and here. And that indeed is expected to happen. So inside the inner edge of an optically thick disk, it is not expected to be optically thick. It's expected to be transparent. Now the other thing to say, there's a point that I was going to make later, but that I'll get to, which is that so an interesting question is, does the innermost stable circular orbit lie inside or outside of the polar light? And the answer is that for a less than or equal to a critical value, which is 0.851 something, the picture is like the one that I drew. And then when A gets bigger than this critical value, then the orbiting would look like this, and your comment would apply. But there is a second important point, which is that this is not what all disks look like. And on the contrary, there is both theoretical and observational evidence that in many disks, even if they are geometrically thin for most of the accretion, that as VR begins to pick up, so the viscosity that is in models of how the inflow takes place, the viscosity that is driving the matter, that is necessary to suck angular momentum out of the matter so that it can fall into the black hole, gets bigger and bigger, and so the inflow velocity gets bigger and bigger until, as you get close to the black hole, the surface density drops until two related things happen. The disk can no longer cool down into a pancake state. And closely related to that is that it becomes, its optical depth goes down to below unity. So in that sort of situation, So disks are not perfectly understood in the way the geodesics of relativistic space cones are. So these numbers are sort of fuzzy. But so, for example, I asked Norm Murray, who's an astrophysicist at CETA, who is smart and knows a lot about this sort of thing, about where this transition takes place. And he said, he was saying, you know, the numbers to keep in mind for that transition from thin to thick in the systems where that happens is kind of 10m-ish, something like that, 10m, which is out beyond the radii where I'm, so that's out beyond the furthest radius that I'm plotting, or roughly comparable to the plotting here. So for those systems, you wouldn't be killed. In other words, the signal would not get the loops that cross through the disk would not get terminated. They would get damped. It would be dimmer by some order unity factor. And so the time delay calculation for these systems would still essentially be unchanged, but there would be a dimming factor for each of these guys. So that's true. So in any case, well.
The burst may have a very specific shape, right?
So that's.
You see a copy of it with the same.
Exactly right.
So the first thing. The last part that you described is appropriate to most AGN, and so you just have to avoid the quasars. The problem is they're the ones that can be the biggest signals in terms of variability.
Sorry, what?
You mean the quasars are the ones that are
going to have these thin disks going right in, whereas...
But still, I mean, even in that case, though, I mean, so you're right. So quasars that are spinning above 0.85 and that are thin all the way in, you're dead. I'm dead. You're fine. To follow up on what Neil said, so here I've just shown an example. Here I've just made up. I've imagined that the burst is just a simple Gaussian, and so the dotted curve here is what the observer would see if there was none of this echo effect, and then this is just to illustrate the J equals one and J equals two bumps superimposed on that. For the case, and I have to say, this looks like a huge effect here, and I have chosen a good case to look at. I've looked at this case where I'm emitting from the inner stable circular orbit of a black hole with spin 0.85, chosen to be, you know, as highly spinning as possible to be consistent with the thin disk picture. So this is, in some sense, this has been chosen to optimize the effect. In any case, there it is. I mean, the more general case is what I showed you on these previous guys. The bottom line is that for a realistic range of radii, for very realistic radii where you expect to be getting the disk to be getting highly variable, and for a realistic range of spins, the effect is detectably large, I claim. And then
I think the question which you're seems to me proposing is that you might use this effect to study the shape of the disk.
Oh yeah, no, that's a good. You mean you could learn something about the accretion disk itself. Now, I think there are probably. I would have to think if there is an actual question about the accretion disk that you could learn more easily this way than you could by other more direct, since the accretion disk ultimately emits like crazy. Directly to you, and there's a lot of information on that. But maybe there's something. I mean, you're right. You're right. That does tell you something about the geometry of where the disk terminates. But
that seems to me that more.
So, and also there is in principle enough. There is in principle. So we are now almost where we are now almost at the state where I am in this project. At this point I neither claim nor rule out the possibility that this effect may already be in existing X-ray data. I think that it can in principle I'm just saying I'm hoping to do this. I haven't done this yet. But I mean, right. So then the question is, now there's certainly enough information in the pattern of time delays and magnifications, even if you only saw the J equals one, even if you only saw the one J equals one loop, couldn't see any of the subsequent ones. That's two numbers, and you have two numbers that you're trying to get at, which is the mass and the spin of the black hole. Even if you had no other observations of those numbers, and of course, actually, for many of these systems, you do have an independent way of, or at least an independent claim of the measurement of the spin. And so indeed, there is in principle enough information to measure these things. Now in practice, given a real ratty signal, how well you could actually do at distinguishing them, I just haven't, maybe you can do well, I just haven't looked into it enough detail. But yeah. Okay, and so the final point that I was going to make on this part of the talk is that furthermore, another nice feature comes with looking face down at the black hole, which is just that the symmetry of the configuration, the azimuthal symmetry of the lensing configuration in this case, means that you are immune to various astrophysical unknowns that usually plague modeling the observations of black holes, right? Because to draw this curve, I didn't have to tell you anything about whether the emission was coming from a single point at this radius or coming from the whole ring at that radius around the black hole or from some arbitrary inhomogeneous distribution in azimuth. That's one of the standard difficult things to model that makes calculations that depend on the sort of pattern of emission near the black hole unreliable. And one is just immune to that. And furthermore, for a similar reason, you know, even if the signal is totally random and you don't know what it is, all you know is that it has a correlation function that decays on time scales shorter than the distance between the subsequent blinkings, then just the mere fact that you see this random signal come to you this way, and then an exact copy of it come to you this way, and a copy of it come to you this way, means that when you cross-correlate those signals, you'll see this autocorrelation peak come back at each of the subsequent blinking times. So it is just more immune to astrophysical uncertainties than many things that you might calculate about a black hole and some of the other things that some of the other ways that people talk about going after observations of a black hole. I think I've already run over. I think I should probably stop here. Okay, so I apologize for not getting to part 3 of my talk.
Any questions?
Can I ask you for the signal on the echo, the kind of event that you're talking about, did it light up the hole, meaning all the way through the disk? Or was it something, for instance, falling onto the disk? Like, I'm just wondering, yeah.
What is the physical thing responsible for?
Yeah, well, I'm just wondering, did you lose signal because if it happened on this side of the disk, one of the signals had to go through the disk?
Well, so in these calculations, I've been calculating the source to be in the equatorial plane, so I've been imagining that it's coming from the disk.
Okay.
Is
that a reasonable assumption?
Well, so, you know, there are. So the thing, there is this famous theory of what a thin disk looks like, and then there's the relativistic generalization of that through the Cajun form, where they calculate time average properties of a thin disk. That, beyond that, things like what is the correlation function of time variability at the disk, what is the physical mechanism responsible for producing the time variability that you see, for example, in X-ray observations of a black hole? Is it magnetic reconnection? Is it some fluid shock happening in the disk? Is the magnetic reconnection right there on top of the disk, or is it somewhere further up in the corona around the disk? These are not known. So for example, there certainly could be sources of the time variability that, you know, so right, if you, let's say the emission comes, let's say I was imagining the emission came from here, so you'd get a nice ray like that, but instead the emission comes from here, and the disk is optically thick here, and so it gets cut off, and the first ray that I see is the one that goes like this. and then yeah, that'll have a big effect. I mean, so that in that sort of system, you wouldn't see the first. In that sort of system, you wouldn't see the first blink, and you would only see the second blink. The bottom line is that there are a lot of uncertainties. There are a lot of things that you don't know astrophysically, and it's the situation is such that yet there is a promising enough effect there that it could conceivably be there. And I think the right thing to do is to just try to look for it at this point, because this sort of astrophysical uncertainty will never be ironed out theoretically. I mean, or not. It'll be looking is easier than ironing those things out.
Reasonable
kind of data. Well, my answer was better than me. I mean, there are kind of tens of. There's two things. There's the X-ray binaries, which are essentially stellar mass black holes, which maybe some of those are located in our galaxy, which typically located in our galaxy. And then there are supermassive black holes, which are responsible for the aging. And we have X-ray data about both. Now, so as I say, the next stage of the project is going to be for me to actually try to see if any of these, try to actually fit these curves to the best variable light curves available. I think that there are kind of light curves extending for longer than the lifetime of the, there are relatively few black holes that have actually been observed whose light curves have been observed well for more than a day of a stretch. Is that fair to say? There's like maybe quarter or 10 or something. We've actually taken exposures of a day.
Probably true.
So if you wanted to see, so if it was a 10 of 9 solar mass black hole, the first blink took a day to happen. I think there's relatively few with that property. Then there are 10 to 6 solar mass black holes where you only need a minute of data. And there's significantly more of that than looking more like.
I'm worried about our galaxy is not a good one.
So the black hole at the center of our galaxy is not very active. There are some things to say about that. So one nice thing about the black hole at the center of our galaxy, which I didn't say in response to, which I didn't get a chance to mention in response to Laurent's question, is that every disk becomes transparent if you look at high enough frequencies. And so in particular, but how high you have to go depends on how thick the accretion flow is, how strong it's accreting. Our black hole at the galactic center is very weakly accreting at this point, and so it actually becomes transparent as long as you look at wavelengths that are above a millimeter. Wavelengths less than a millimeter, frequencies higher, frequencies above millimeter wave frequencies. So in other words, basically for almost all frequencies you would look at, except for radio. So it's good in that sense, and if a time variable flash went off. There's a couple things to say. One is that its spin is not known. One of my colleagues at CETA, Avery Broderick, I'm actually not supposed to say this again because it's about Avery's time. I don't know whether it's for it might be a good story here.
So Lathan, there's a couple of things here. You've shown the temporal spectrum, but you didn't show the wavelength spectrum. In other words, where would you see? You're going to get some gravitational redshift in there. So that's question one.
Question two is
for the X-rays, the biggest issue you're going to have to worry about is neutral gas around there. And basically, for a sample, it's really the Compton thick objects that are going to kill you. And most objects aren't Compton thick. That corresponds to a column about 10 to the 24. Along the line of sight. So there should still be hope in the X-ray, but you haven't shown the spectrum. You've only shown the temporal.
Okay, so another nice feature of looking down the axis. And so let me say, so the reason that I have to look down the axis, apart from the motivations that I give, is that
what happens as I begin to vary off the axis? Well, as long as I don't vary too far, nothing bad happens. As long as I vary an angle that is small relative to 2 pi, well, first of all, you can show that the magnification, the brightness of each subsequent image, doesn't vary. The relative brightness doesn't vary at first order in that deflection angle. It only begins to vary at second order. So it's a slowly varying cap. So there's a cap
about the polar cap, where the magnification calculation that I showed should be pretty good. The time delay, the central time delay, also doesn't vary at first order, but what does happen is that at first order you begin to smear because light rays that came around this way now have a little bit different path length than light rays that came around this way. And you know, you can see that smearing will smear the two successive peaks into one another when you get down to pi over 2. So as long as you've moved a small distance relative to pi over 2 away from the top, you're good smearing wise as well. Okay, but so we're thinking about some region relatively near the pole. And so then that is prefaced to, so the answer to your question is that, first of all, it turns out that for this observer, that every ray that reaches him, they're all redshifted, of course, because they're coming from near the black hole. But each blink is redshifted by the same amount. So it is a colorless effect, and it doesn't depend. So in other words, whatever frequency you look at, the time delay and relative magnifications don't depend on what frequency you're looking at. The redshift is the same for all frequencies, and the redshift is the same for the polar observer. The redshift is the same for every ray which reaches him. So it's another thing that could in principle be used as a cross, you know, consistency check, is that there is a strong prediction here that you should see, if you can observe an event in two different frequencies, you should see exactly the same pattern, assuming that what could happen is that the optical depth near the black hole, like you say, you know, if there's neutral hydrogen near the black hole, that could obscure some frequencies more than at other frequencies, and that sort of thing would mess up that. But just geometrically, just in terms of the geometric optics of the problem, you predict exactly the same thing regardless of frequency.
I'm trying to imagine the geometry here. So the frame bracket, the blackboard there, the beams of light would be pulled out of the two-dimensional plane.
Right. So I'm looking down, the black hole spinning like this. So frame direction, of course, only happens if the rays get pulled in this direction. And so there's two answers to your question. First of all, the rays that propagate to me definitely will be dragged around the hole by some amount. But first of all, you can show that you don't have to follow that motion, because the calculation that you have to do, you imagine a little plaquette in the disk, a little plaquette of area, infinitesimal plaquette, lights up, and it has radius dr and width d theta, d phi, in the azimuthal direction. Now, as the rays propagate to you, they will move around. But what you can show is that the dr will get squashed by the geometry, but the d phi will not. The d phi of the image that you ultimately see on the sky, it will be moved to some different, as you look down, you know, maybe the original image came from over here, and you'll see it over here. But in terms of calculating the time delay and the magnification, you don't need to know what azimuth it was at in the intermediate time before it ultimately arrived to you at the pole.
Are you assuming the source is emitting anisotropically?
Yes, I am. Mm-hmm. That's right. So I'm imagining the emission is coming I'm thinking in my head of a fluid element in the disk, and so I'm imagining it in a circular orbit around the black hole, emitting isotropically relative to its local rest frame, which is the standard assumption. I mean, it's the standard assumption in these calculations, but there are systems where that's wrong. Especially with my,
I'm wondering, are there proposals for alternative gravitational theories, general relativity, that would agree in the weak field regime but disagree in the strong field regime, and which you could rule out by these sorts of tests?
So that's another interesting question. So the answer is yes, of course. That there are, you know, theories that agree with GR, but for example have added terms that are quadratic in gravity or higher than quadratic in curvature in the action. But can be tuned to agree in the solar system, at least at the classical level. I mean, that's the one. Anyway, but So this does seem like it would be a great place to look for such deviations. So just like in response to the question about the mass, measuring the mass and spin, that's the actual parameter constraints that you could place given realistic data. I don't know. And I mean, in other words, the reason that it definitely will work is that the Kerr, you know, the Kerr metric played a central role in this analysis, and that's the solution for a black hole, assuming the action is just the Einstein-Hilbert term. And if you add other terms in the action, the solution will be different, and it will be most different as you get into the strong curvature regime near the black hole. And so the geodesics will be different also. And so things will change, whether they change by how big the terms in the action have to be before they produce a detectably large change.
Good. I think we're going to call it quits. Let's thank Nathan again.